This is February 10th, Masoret. We're taking up some Rashis in Parshas Mishpatim. Essentially, Mishpatim is dealing with very mundane types of laws governing society, damages, wounds, things of that sort. It's not restricted to that, but that seems... Judgments, Mishpatim. Mishpatim pertains to the laws that govern society, specifically the laws that govern relationships between people, and specifically where it comes to damaging. One person damages another. So that's a significant idea, obviously. What's difficult about the theme of the Parsha is most people don't associate that with religion. That just seems to, that seems to be a human necessity. You can't have society without it. And you can't have any kind of a organization without rules that govern the rights of people and so on and so forth. But specifically, it's an impossibility to have a society where there's not going to be mistakes are made, properties are damaged, people attack each other and so forth. So you have to have rules and regulations. What's interesting about it is that this forms a significant part of Torah, which most people wouldn't associate with religion. Yet in Judaism, it's not just part of the religion, it's a very significant part of the religion. But I'm not going into that right now. It's not limited just to that. Another major theme of the Parsha has to do with the treatment of people. And not just any people, but you'll see that's a major theme. The treatment of those who are vulnerable, weak and vulnerable people. It starts off with the Eved Ivri, with the Jewish servant, someone who has been sold into slavery or sold himself into slavery. Because he can't pay back a theft, if he stole and he can't pay it back, or even if he's in poverty and he sold himself. And the Torah is very, very demanding in terms of how he's to be treated. You can't take advantage of him in any way, shape, or form. And the rabbis say that one who purchases a Eved Ivri, it's like he purchased a master. There are other illustrations of that idea of being extremely sensitive to those who are weak. It's sort of like a sub-theme of the Parsha. You see it in terms of lending money to, obviously, a person who's poor, and you lend him money and you want to take security. So if you take his garment, his day garment, then you have to make sure that he has use of it during the day. If it's an evening garment, you must make sure that he has it in the evening. But there it introduces the theme. It's not just a matter of justice, ordinary justice, but v'hayaki yitzak elai, if he screams out to me, v'shamati, I will hear, ki chanan ani, because Hashem is saying that he's compassionate. That's not the only case. There's a whole parsha about those who afflict. We did this parsha probably a number of times. In chapter 22, the ger, afflicting the ger, that's one category. Almana is another category. And yosom, three categories of people. What do they all have in common? That they're vulnerable and they're targets. So the Torah makes a special case about that. About not, so that becomes a major theme, because you already have the Eved Ivri, you already have the poor person who has to come to you for money. Not tzedakah, it's a case where he's borrowing money and you're taking a security from him. So that could also be a means of affliction, because he's really dependent upon it. So if you don't return it to him, and at night he's cold because he doesn't have his blanket, and then he cries out to Hashem, Hashem will hear that prayer. That's another important idea. We see from this that that's a major issue with regard to prayer. When is prayer heard? Are all prayers heard? Not all prayers are necessarily heard. And the Rambam says, that's, according to the Rambam, that's the whole significance of tefillah b'tzibur. That the tefillah of the tzibur is always heard. So therefore a person should always join together with the tzibur for the purpose of tefillah, and not daven by themselves. The tefillah of the yachid, of the individual, can be heard, but there's no guarantee. This is important. It implies to women as well. Obviously, women have to juggle their responsibilities, essentially, when they have young children and things of that sort. So they don't have the same type of an obligation. They do have an obligation with tefillah, as we learned. But running to shul to grab a minyan, they don't have the same obligation. However, it should be pointed out, and that's why when the issue of women's prayer groups came up, I mean, there's a number of issues, but one of the issues that we analyzed it from was the standpoint of you're depriving women, since a group of women don't constitute a tzibur, and since if they do go to the shul, they do join together with the tzibur and get the benefit, their tefillah then is considered to be tefillah of the tzibur, so then by not going to shul, they're being deprived of that benefit. But here, yeah, questions being raised, and I can only deal with it briefly now. It's a good question. What does it mean God hears the prayer? Of course, it doesn't mean in the sense of, like we would say, that he heard, did you hear what I said? That is, a human being may hear or may not hear, depending upon the physical factors. Of course, with Hashem, Hashem knows everything. It means, though, in the sense that, from our perspective, that if you presented a petition, the question would be, would it be heard? That's a level, that's a status. You want at least your petition to reach the desk of the president or whatever. I don't know that, I'm not sure it could have the connotation of that Hashem heard our prayers in the sense of responding to it. I'm not absolutely sure if that's what it means. We do use the expression that God should hear our prayers in the sense that that God should respond. That's probably what it means. The only thing is that the way Hashem responds to it may not always be in accordance with the way we would imagine it to be. On a human level, it's important to us that He heard us. It doesn't mean to say we're going to get what we want. Now I'm wondering, so there's a difference then. On the human level, when you're talking about addressing people for things you need, so I think we'll all acknowledge that obviously when we make a petition for certain things, the ultimate hope is that we'll be granted what we requested. But there's different levels. Sometimes at least you got your point through and they heard. Doesn't mean you got what you wanted, but at least they heard. So there's a difference between being heard and getting what you want. On the human level. Now I'm wondering if it's the same with prayer. Because that's one of the brachas of Shema Kolenu, hear our voice. But if you take a look at the Shemone Esrei, V'kabel barachim uveratzon es tefilasenu, we're asking God to accept our prayers with mercy and ratzon, with will, with God's approval, so to speak. And that's it. But we don't say, and give us what we're asking for. Obviously, that's the implication. Because the person will say, well, what's the good of our prayer being heard if we're not going to get anything as a result? I think that's what the average person would, that would be the next question. Is there a benefit then, that the tefillah is heard? The general sense is that it's not just on the human level. Sometimes on the human level, your prayers may be heard, or your requests may be heard, but you won't get what you asked for. Now, in the Torah it does say that the prayers came before Hashem. It describes that. V'atal shavasam elohakim. That their prayers went up to God. That's the in when the Jews were in Egypt, and God knew, so to speak. It means it will have consequences. Let's put it that way. It could be that the language is because accept our prayers. It would be perhaps a little bit chutzpah to tell God what to do. But we're expressing the fact that we have absolute trust and faith in Hashem. Except that we should reach the level where our prayers have significance to Him. That's all. Once that's the case, we have confidence that we will be taken care of. So I think that's a good way of putting it. Thus, over here, the Torah is making that point that there are certain categories of people who, when they cry out to me, I will hear. Obviously, in this context, it's clear because the very next pasuk says that for if they will cry out to me, the almana, the yasom, etc., if they cry. Shamoa eshmatzakaso, I will hear it. V'chara api, and my anger will flare. So here too, the hearing is associated with action. So that makes a lot of sense, that the acceptance of the prayer implies action. It'll be acted upon. It's only in the case of a human ruler who will sometimes hear and not do, because the human being is limited. So sometimes I just can't do anything about it. But at least I can hear. And that might give some people comfort. But I don't know that that's the meaning. That would be very difficult to say that with regard to Hashem. Because what's the point of hearing? And then you don't do anything about it. Then it's like no difference between being heard and not being heard. So therefore, it does imply consequences. And you see that that's a very significant idea, that prayer should be heard. In fact, that's why there's a separate bracha. We don't just pray. It's a strange kind of bracha. I mean, what are you praying for? You're by virtue of praying, you're assuming that God hears. So why should we have a separate prayer of Shema Kolenu? After we finish praying, now we're saying, hear our voice. Well, one second. If there's any doubt, then why did you pray in the first place? Because that's something that a person has to pray for. A person shouldn't assume that God just hears his prayers. That's haughtiness. And that's what the Rambam is saying. Thus, when the individual prays, it's not a guarantee that the prayer will be heard. That's what he's saying. It's not heard at all times. Doesn't mean that he didn't fulfill the mitzvah. I think it's not because he didn't daven properly according to halacha. I don't think that's not what he means. Because if that's the case, you daven properly according to halacha, then what's the advantage of minyan? What's the difference? It means that even if you fulfilled your responsibility halachically, that doesn't always guarantee that the prayer is heard. That just means you fulfilled your halachic responsibility. The tefillah of certain people who are very vulnerable and are being oppressed by others, their prayer is heard. That's what the parsha is teaching us. According to the Ramban, it's a universal point. And I don't have the Ramban in front of me. But in general, that's my recollection, that he's saying that we as a people experienced that in Egypt, that we too were in that same situation of vulnerability. And God heard, and we prayed to God, and God heard our prayers. Because that's a major foundation, that God does not ignore the oppressed. The Ramban's point, however, is a very interesting point. Because he's saying that God has a special relationship, so to speak, with the oppressed. That many people will challenge that and say, well, there's so many oppressed peoples out there and we don't necessarily see that there's divine intervention or even that there's punishment of those who afflict them. But there's one thing in the pasuk over here which I pointed out in the past, and that is that it doesn't say that if you afflict him, then my anger will flare at you and so forth. It says, if you should afflict him, and if he cries out to me. So it's not a direct relationship between the affliction and the punishment. There's an intermediary step. That is, you afflict him, and if he should cry out to me, I'll listen to his scream. That's that's important also even in the Bnei Yisrael. That God did not intervene until they cried out to Hashem, and until their prayers reached Hashem. So that's a very significant thing. I'm not saying it's the only thing. I can't give an accounting of every event in history when people were oppressed and what took place, obviously. But what the Torah is teaching us, however, it seems to me, is that the mere fact of the oppression itself is not what will necessarily call forth the anger. Of course, whoever does that is a very grave sin, and whatever, he'll face the consequences. But what these particular consequences that are being described over here, and they're very severe, as we've said, that I will make your wives into almanos, and in a permanent kind of way. As Rashi says that, I think it's Rashi, that not just that the men will die, but they'll die in a war situation or something where it will not even be possible to determine for sure that he's dead, so the wife will always be a widow. She won't be able to remarry, and the child won't be able to inherit, so he'll always be like an orphan. So it's very severe penalties. That seems to be associated not just with the affliction, but with the fact that the person cries out. I think this is a very significant point, and it's not the kind of thing that I think the average individual would be able to see. And that, because the average individual is bothered by oppression. It bothers everyone except the ones that are doing the oppression. But ordinary people, decent people, have a certain sympathy for the victim. Of course, we always identify. So we have a tremendous desire that the wicked people should be punished, they should be destroyed, because they deserve it. We also have a intrinsic feeling that the victims should be protected. And that's a... See, the Torah doesn't just go in accordance with people's feelings. If you read this thing superficially, the average person reading it superficially will feel good about it. You see, God comes to the rescue. I mean, I'm forget about whether the person goes beyond and starts asking, what about this case, what about that case, but just by reading it. When you read this parsha, it resonates. But if you read it very closely the way we're reading it, it could lead to a problem. Because the average person, I don't think, is going to stop and make that deduction. That's only if he cries out to God. But if he doesn't cry out to God, then perhaps the oppressor will not be punished. Now, once you make that step, and you make that deduction, which I think is a valid one, then it becomes a little bit problematical for the average person. Because what difference does it make? It's evil. And if you're telling me that God doesn't tolerate evil, so, okay, the person did cry out to him, didn't cry, but just because he didn't cry out to God, then the evil will be tolerated. Why should that be? However, we do learn something. And it would seem that this type of a hashkacha. Now, let me just decide. I'm not saying that, I don't mean to say that with regard to God intervening to put an end to certain types of evil, that that's only where the victims cry out. I'm not saying that. There, we read about Sodom and Amorah, and God's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. There's many principles, like the Rambam says, that God judges the individual, God judges the Medina, and so on and so forth. So in the case of Sodom, where Sodom, that's the example he gives, was destroyed because of their wickedness. It says that Hashem says, the Zakas Sodom, the cry of Sodom, is great, and Amora is very great. So the Erdon of the era, God says, I'll go down and I'll see. Obviously, that's not to be taken literally. It means that there'll be a very close review now. Whether the scream is in accordance with the actuality. I'm not sure what the scream, well, does the scream refer to who? Does the scream refer to people crying to God, or is the scream talking about the affliction? The people are being afflicted. Screaming isn't always prayer. People scream because of their pain. They don't always necessarily cry out to Hashem. My sense of the Sodom and Gomorrah is not because they were righteous people that were crying out to a God, but rather the screams is a result of the suffering that they oppressed, the cruelty. So there, it's not necessarily that God, see, in that situation, God did not come to the rescue, so to speak. There's different situations. The only person that was rescued by the divine intervention was Lot, because Lot was a separate story, that he had merit. So he wasn't destroyed with them. But the purpose of the divine intervention was not to save Lot, because Lot was not being persecuted. The only time he got in trouble was when the strangers came and he tried to give them hospitality and so forth. But that the whole thing is because God was destroying Sodom. Sodom was destroyed because of a different principle. The principle of evil, that a nation can reach such a degree of corruption that it's not deemed worthy of existence. God will destroy it. That's one thing. You have that also by Nineveh. But by Nineveh, they were given a chance to do tshuva, in which they did. But that wasn't to save anybody. So that's a different situation. Here we're finding out something different, that God will rescue the oppressed from the oppressor. When that takes place, and it's not a question that God is going to punish the oppressor because of his evil per se, but rather God is going to intervene to rescue the victim, so then it's going to be because there's a connection between God and the victim. There's a connection between God and the victim. And that's expressed through the tefillah. Apparently that's another factor which enhances the tefillah. That's a general idea, that today everybody tries to get people to pray for someone. It's a very popular notion. But the most significant prayer is that which the person says for himself, because he's the one who's suffering. He feels the pain. So that person's, all things being equal, that person puts all their heart into the tefillah. The practice today, especially with the internet, you know, you get all these lists from people across the United States or elsewhere across the world. Please pray for so-and-so and put them on your list. That idea is a bit difficult, let's put it this way. Because what you wind up doing is saying prayers, and you put in these names of people you don't even know, just for the sake of mentioning them in a Mishnah Berurah or whatever. What's wrong with that practice is that real prayer? I mean, prayer has to have a real meaning. And in order for it to have a meaning, you have to be involved on some level. Now, if you're not involved on any level, it doesn't really mean anything to you. And it's not your fault that it doesn't mean anything to you. You're a human being. you care about certain people, people you know, your family, your children, etc. Someone who's a complete stranger, you know, it's not that you don't care, it's just that how can you possibly have any feelings about the case? You're not involved in any way, shape, or form. So then it becomes pretty much just by rote. But I think that the people behind it, the idea somehow is that the tefillah becomes a magical thing. So you just include their name. And the tefillah works in some kind of a magical way. You know, they'll sort of be like left out of the prayer. You don't want to be left out of the prayer. But that's not the idea of tefillah. The idea of tefillah is that there's a certain reality to the tefillah. That God hears prayer. What is prayer? Prayer is that man spills his sicha, so to speak. L'fnei Hashem yishpach sicha. Before God, tefillah la'ani kiyatov. The prayer of the ani, kiyatov, that he, the prayer of the destitute person, kiyatov, he's sort of like atifa, he covers himself. L'fnei Hashem yishpach sicha. And before God, he pours forth his speech. That's the idea, that a person turns to God and it's a heartfelt thing and he pours out his heart to God. That's what prayer is. You see that in the tefillah of Chana. She kept pouring out her heart to Hashem. So obviously, the factor of the kavana, the thought, the intention, the sincerity and so forth is of the essence. Thus, to simply say prayers and you're not really involved in it at all, you're just going through the motions, is a big problem. The pasuk over here is saying that God will intervene as a response to the tefillah of the victim. So a person in that situation has a tremendous opportunity. And the warning, that's what God is warning, interestingly enough. God is warning us not to engage in this behavior. Of course, we shouldn't do it because it's the wrong thing to do. But the warning is that you will be in a very dangerous situation. Because, I mean, not everything you do wrong puts you in the same situation. Because of the way the Hashgacha works. So of course you shouldn't do the wrong thing. You're harming yourself, you're harming your soul. There could be consequences in terms of reward and punishment. But here it's very specific. And that is that you run the risk that this person will turn to me. And if the person does, then I will respond to their prayer. And then you'll be in big trouble. But that's the way it works. It's not the same if the person doesn't pray to me. Well, it's true. When a person is in an Esara, it is an obligation to cry out. According to the Ramban, that's when tefillah is obligatory, midiraisa. That's the Ramban's position. Now, the Rambam, as you know, holds that it's intrinsically a mitzvah to pray at least once a day, midiraisa, according to the Torah. The Ramban has a lengthy dispute with him on that, and he comes to the conclusion that tefillah per se on a daily basis is rabbinic, but he acknowledges that there is a situation where it's d'oraisa, that's when it's a time of trouble. Even there, I don't know that there's any guarantee that the prayer will be heard or answered. This is a specific situation which comes with the guarantee that Hashem will hear. That's what God is saying. If you afflict him and he cries out to me, I will hear his prayer. And then it says the hearing clearly implies response.